During weeks, this debate has been a festival of discrimination towards Muslims.
French Interior Minister Darmanin already said that mosques will be closely monitored. Law experts say that this text can be interpreted in different ways, which could lead to arbitrary decisions like the closure of watchdog associations defending the rights of Muslims. Opposition members in the parliament blame the government for not being concerned about the real social problems of the population.
Yes, there is a separatism in this country, a separatism in school and in the French territory. This bill does not speak about it. Our children, depending on which school they go to, do not have the same chances. The public school is weakened.
The opposition group in the French parliament also criticizes the actual French government for seducing far-right voters, as the new French president will be elected in only a year. What is more important, security issues or social welfare?
We had 2 years of social agitation with a yellow vest movement and a movement against the retirement law. The poverty and social inequality are exploding in France, but no, they debate on the headscarf.
The reaction of the Muslim community is taking form, but slowly and in a dispersed order. Hundreds demonstrated in Paris, and hundreds of religious leaders and human rights associations asked members of parliament in a public letter not to vote this law on separatism. The law has been adopted by a majority in the French parliament, but Muslims and human rights defenders already promised to continue the protest. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
Turkish president vowed that the cross-border military operations that Turkish military is conducting against PKK will continue, as he confirmed Ankara's willingness to expand areas of operations from which threats against Turkey are coming, assuring that the death of 13 Turkish citizens who lost their lives in the Gara attack will strengthen the government's determination to eliminate terrorist groups.
Northern Iraq's Gara province has now been made secure as a result of a 4-day military operation. We will stay in the areas that we have made safe in a bid to avoid similar attacks. Gara was a troubled region. It is taken now, and the problem is gone.
Turkish Defense Minister, along with Interior Minister, met with opposition figures Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu and Meral Akşener separately and explained in details the military operation that was conducted in the region. The two ministers also briefed the parliament on the circumstances of the operation and the martyrdom of 13 Turkish citizens on the hands of PKK. Analysts say the meetings and parliament session were in preparation to draft a resolution to grant the Turkish army the permission to hold wide-range cross-border operation in Sinjar and other areas in northern Iraq.
The war between Turkey and the PKK has been going on for decades. However, I think this time a decision is being made to eliminate the group's terrorists wherever they are. The operation will include Sinjar and Kandil areas. I think all political parties will agree on launching a wider cross-border operation, despite knowing that such a decision will be met with opposition from European countries and, of course, Turkey's NATO ally, the United States.
Turkey accused the U.S. of siding with terrorists. Turkish president said the U.S. statement concerning the death of 13 Turkish citizens is considered, quote, a joke. Other Turkish politicians and political parties also condemned it, saying the U.S. exposed its cooperation with PKK in such a statement. It seems that, unlike Turkish expectations, the new U.S. administration, like its predecessors, will continue to support the Kurdish groups. Many expect the two NATO allies go into another round of tensions. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerced some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion. But Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aufer started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aufer jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aufer. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prison's officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aufer to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aufer jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aufer, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Muna Qandil, Occupy Jamallah.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent. And what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high. And former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
But there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in, getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iran has informed the International Atomic Energy Agency it plans to stop taking voluntary measures that give the agency broader access under the so-called Additional Protocol. Iran has been implementing the Additional Protocol voluntarily as part of its commitments under the nuclear deal with world powers known as the JCPOA.
I have delivered a letter from the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the Director General of the IAEA specifying that as of 23rd February 2021, Iran will stop all voluntary measures beyond its safeguard commitments as envisaged in the JCPOA.
Kazem Gharibabadi said as of February 23rd, cooperation between Iran and the IAEA would be based solely on the country's safeguards agreement with the agency. If U.S. sanctions are effectively lifted, he added, Iran would resume implementation of all voluntary measures. The decision is in line with a law approved by the Iranian parliament almost 2 months ago, obliging the government to reduce IAEA access and step up nuclear enrichment if U.S. sanctions are not lifted, specifically those imposed against Iranian oil exports and the country's banking system. The previous U.S. administration under President Donald Trump reimposed the sanctions as part of a maximum pressure policy after withdrawing from the nuclear deal in 2018. Meanwhile, Iran has also informed the IAEA of its serious concerns over the protection of confidential information. In an official letter, Iran has asked the agency to revise its policies in order to avoid the far too common instances of IAEA reports being leaked to the media via unauthorized access, potentially threatening the country's national security. Since it was implemented in 2016, the nuclear deal has given the IAEA unprecedented access to Iranian nuclear sites. But that level of cooperation would inevitably come to an end if efforts to revive the JCPOA fail. Homolezgi, Vienna.
Ex-President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his second impeachment trial, finally closing the curtain on the nation's bitterly disputed election last November. Trump was accused of incitement to insurrection after a violent protest stormed Capitol Hill as Congress was certifying the Electoral College's selection of Joe Biden. Polls still show that around 40% of voters think that Biden's victory was illegitimate. Public opinion was almost evenly split regarding Trump's responsibility in the Capitol Hill protests and along party lines. The Senate vote's outcome was never in doubt, as a two-thirds supermajority was needed for conviction. The trial was surprisingly rushed to completion.
Trump's big sin, from the point of view of the American ruling class, is that he brought the pitchforks to the castle. And that's what the ruling class is, and the entire apparatus of status quo politics in the United States is punishing Donald Trump for, and wants to make sure never happens again.
Democrats now have to contend with an exonerated Trump who can run for the presidency in 2024. Conservatives may be permanently divided into two factions, and polls show that a third party started by Trump would be even more popular than the Republican Party. The final fate of the controversial Trump seemed to overshadow what sparked the violent protest in the first place, yet the question remains: how can massive and violent disputes over electoral integrity be prevented?
A, have an electoral system that people have confidence in and can have confidence in, which we don't have. But even more, hey, we're giving you medical care. You have medical care. Your rent is paid. You have a job. You have an income. You know, you don't have to worry about student debt. How many of those people are going to come to fight you over that?
Other questions remain, which are even more difficult to answer. Can a Trump-obsessed nation actually move on? Will Washington now focus on fixing the socioeconomic catastrophes caused by the coronavirus and lockdowns? How can this deeply divided nation heal? And when? And maybe, do they even want to? Given Trump's acquittal, many wonder if the impeachment trial ultimately did more harm than good. The Trump presidential era may be definitively over, finally, but the transition to get there was anything but peaceful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
ایستگاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning. How is everything?
Good morning, Mom.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Debate.
The leader of Lebanon's resistance movement has warned Israel that any act of aggression against Lebanon could lead to an all-out war. Said Hassan Nasrallah said that Hezbollah does not seek a military confrontation, but if it's pushed into one, it will display a resistance stronger than ever before. In this edition of Debate, we will look at the possibilities of a war between Israel and Lebanon and whether Israel is adequately prepared for one.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah's Secretary General warned Israel
that any act of aggression on the Gaza Strip or Lebanon could turn into an all-out war.
In any future confrontation, the home front of the occupation entity will face actualities it has never faced since the establishment of its entity. The time of threats and fear is over. The Resistance Alliance is following up all developments with calm and precision.
Nasrallah reiterated that the Israelis, especially Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, will continue to magnify normalization deals with some Arab states and use the issue for political and electoral gains. Hezbollah's leader, however, stressed that the people of the region will continue to boycott Israel.
Even in those Arab states that are normalizing ties, we bargain on the people. This is the struggle of the people. I'm telling them they do not need to take on arms or shed blood. All you need to do is boycott, which means do not normalize ties. Do not accept Israeli products or meet with Israelis or visit Israelis or welcome Israelis.
Experts believe the resistance has had exceptional achievements in its struggle against the Israeli regime.
The resistance has achieved two victories unprecedented in Arab and Muslim history and has achieved two liberations. Had it not been for the resistance, there would have not been a Lebanon. We need to remember that in 2000 and in 2006, there was no Arab side with the resistance. On the contrary, they conspired against it. There are many challenges facing it. There will be more people against it, and the Israelis will try to continue with their efforts to normalize ties with more Arab regimes while the resistance has become a united regional power.
Nasrallah was speaking on the anniversary of the martyrdom of Hezbollah's former Secretary General, Sayyid Abbas Mousawi, scholar Sheikh Raghib Harb, and military commander Imad Mughni. The martyrdom of these leaders, although at different intervals in the history of the resistance, represents the continued path toward liberation. After some 40 years of resistance and struggle against Israeli occupation and Takfiri terrorism, Hezbollah has lost many commanders, three of whom are commemorated in February of every year. And despite gaining strength and the many victories, Hezbollah's resistance is constantly in a state of defending Lebanon and advocating the need to remain apprehensive of U.S., Israeli, and Takfiri threats. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Joining us in this debate, activist and political analyst Laith Malouf joins us from Beirut. We have journalist and political analyst Julia Kassem, who also joins us from Beirut. I'd like to welcome you both. Laith Malouf, let me first start with you. The Israeli forces holding these large-scale exercises along the northern border with Lebanon. Why did Israel perform these exercises to warrant a warning from Hezbollah?
Well, basically, they have been conducting exercises for the past year and a half. Almost every couple of months, we see apartheid Israel doing exercises in the Golan Heights, in the northern Galilee of occupied Palestine. And it is all partially because of they are projecting psychological warfare on the peoples of Syria and Lebanon, but also because apartheid Israel itself knows that its armed forces, its land forces specifically, are not ready for any war, an actual invasion of any country. And if there's a confrontation on the borders with Lebanon, their army, the land forces, are going to be defeated resoundingly very fast. And so apartheid Israel is very worried on its future, what will happen in a confrontation with a force like Hezbollah that is professional and dedicated to its just cause. We know without the land force, there couldn't be any victory for apartheid Israel.
Okay, well, Julia Kassem, just to expand a little bit more on this, we've seen also the air maneuvers take place by Israeli forces. They called it the Rose of the Galilee, involved dozens of jets. And we also know that there was a scenario where the Lebanese Hezbollah group fired a missile at an IF. This is a scenario now. It landed the shot but failed to bring down the aircraft. It almost sounds like looks like Israel is trying to provoke Hezbollah either in terms of a mindset that, hey, we're preparing for a war, or that this is what our capabilities are, in which then you have the warning coming from Hezbollah. How do you see the way that Israel has displayed itself and in turn the warning coming from Hezbollah?
Israel has known for full well now that any provocation that leads to war or any war between itself and the resistance is going to be a losing battle, not militarily in an isolated context, but an existential loss for the occupying entity. It is well aware of Hezbollah's military capabilities that have exceeded Israel's ability to really, fight them and win. Israel knows that it's going to lose in battle, so it knows it will absolutely be decimated. So for the past at least a couple of years now, you've seen a lot of psychological provocations by Israel. If you remember, in mid to late 2019, a lot of the provocations at the border by Israel, which coincided with strikes along the Iraq-Syria border and whatnot. This last Christmas, the day after Christmas, we did have a low-flying jet, Israeli aircraft, as just another maneuver of psychological terror. And it's no surprise right now that we have nearly daily violations of airspace over Lebanon. Israeli drones coming in and out daily, and a lot of these go and end up striking Syria as well. So when this provocation is, a part of it is definitely a flexing of muscles to kind of show, to try to posture that there is capabilities, even though Israel well knows that there isn't capability sufficient to defeat the resistance. And an incitation that wants to, fight, basically posture psychologically without having to really, while keeping, saving face, kind of in the midst of electoral and political disarray in Israel, complete lack of soldier morale. You have soldiers just refusing to fight. The Israeli army is weaker than ever. So they're basically trying to prove in front psychologically and in airspace what they clearly can't deliver on the ground.
Okay, so since we're talking about the Israeli, well, it's funny that we were talking about the Israeli military, once regarded to be one of the most powerful militaries in the world, but at this point it has now been degraded to, well, let me not say it myself. I'm going to use the top general back in 2018 of Israel, who said Israel not ready for war, in which he said Israeli military has invested most of its resources in the Air Force while neglecting the Land Corps, leaving Israel vulnerable to Hezbollah. How did Israel get to this point, Leif Maruf?
It got to this point with the democratization of military technologies that happened in the last decade. So beyond the fact that Hezbollah's tactics have surpassed those of Israel in their ability to expel the occupation from Lebanon in 2000, in its tactics to defeat the invasion of 2006 and withstand the bombardment from the air. But now, added to all of that, we have a democratization of military technology that happened in the last two decades. So we see smaller actors able to build drones that can go to very far locations and pinpoint hits, as well as cruise missiles being proliferated within the smaller actors. So we have now a situation where a country with the most advanced air power and the most advanced surveillance technologies in the world is not able to defeat smaller players like Yemen and Hezbollah and Syria in their battles. So this is a grave danger for apartheid Israel and for the imperialist camp, and they know that, and they can see it in fact through tested battles of now the years that we saw in Yemen and the withstanding of the people there. So Hezbollah definitely is ready. Apartheid Israel knows it. The United States knows it. And all they can do is just bark as loud as they can thinking that that's going to make them look like that they are strong.
Yeah, well, barking is one thing, but Julia Qassem, they are actually carrying out military operations inside Syria. They have bombed Syria on a number of occasions. The reasoning twofolds. One, Iranian positions, which Iran has said were there at the invitation of the Syrian government in the role of advisories, and also Hezbollah fighters who are in Syria. And let's not forget that initially the presence of Hezbollah fighters along with Iranian advisory roles were to defeat the Daesh terrorists. What's your view on the way that Israel is targeting Hezbollah fighters in Syria?
Yeah, you know, Israel is an expanding U.S. military base, essentially. And the defeats successively in 2000, the liberation of Lebanon 2000, with the inability for Israel to really, you know, beat Hezbollah and, in fact, actually strengthen the resistance's capabilities. And again, after the Syrian war, when Syria became the target as the supporter and ally of the resistance, its failure there has basically posed an existential threat to its expansionism, its role as like its propagation of being the strongest military in the world. You know, Syria now is a prime target, partially for its you know, ever present expansionist tendencies, but also for the ground forces present at the invitation from the Syrian government of Hezbollah and of Iran as well, that Israel wants to target. It wants to take down Syria as one of the supporters and allies, but it also wants to take down Iran and Hezbollah in Syria as the backbone of what has assisted and sustained Syria from falling to ruin, and in turn also the resistances in Lebanon, in Palestine, and in elsewhere in Iraq as well, that work hand in hand together to basically kind of thwart all plots of occupation. And we see that the Damascus has been that target for those exact reasons.
Well, we're looking at a new U.S. administration here, Leif Maruf. We know that Trump, obviously a staunch supporter of Israel, had very much the backing of the U.S. when it came to anything that Israel pretty much said. But things, I think, may be changing now with this new U.S. administration, because we're seeing in the news, for example, how the U.S., through Biden, is going to reset its relationship with Israel. Does Israel have any backing when it comes to its thoughts on military engagements with Hezbollah or Lebanon in general, even though you have, for example, the French president who come and said Hezbollah is part of the government there, it's part of the political institution there, you know, and it's got to be included. So you don't have Israel exactly having the backing of the so-called international community, which in essence really comes down to the U.S. in its case.
Well, really, it's just an exchange of roles between France and the United States and some other European countries. They play this game of the good cop, bad cop, but ultimately they're there to maintain apartheid Israel and the hegemony of the West over Western Asia and North Africa through the existence of this beachhead military colony that we call Israel. So that's one thing. The other thing that we need to notice is that what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech yesterday in regards to the change in priorities for the Biden regime. You know, there is no real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of what their strategic goals are, which is maintaining American hegemony and power over the region here. But they have differed on tactics and or priorities. So we may see, you know, Russia and China taking more of the brunt of American attention with the Biden regime, than you know, the Middle East, Western Asia, North Africa. So, of course, the regional viceroys and vessels of the United States, mainly Saudi Arabia and apartheid Israel, they're going to get less support and attention because the United States wants to butt heads with the big two, China and Russia. And this is very important for the resistance and all people that in the region here to understand that, yes, although the United States is turning its attention towards China and Russia, if there is a battle here on the ground, the United States will be back in a jiffy.
Well, what are we looking at then in the future, for the future, Julia Qassem, when it comes to these two? Israel obviously has done its best. Of course, it's been defeated, the most prominent defeat being the 2006 war. We could talk about other instances, but at this point, given the passage of time, we know how more advanced, as our guest there, Leif Maruf, indicated also, that Hezbollah has gotten militarily. And it shows, especially with some recent downing of Israeli drones, for example, that Hezbollah is adequately prepared, not to mention the tens or hundreds of thousands of rockets that it may have, and pretty much everybody knows where they are pointed at. What future do you see between the two?
So the capability is there, but the strategy with Hezbollah, with Iran, often obviously precedes, the capability. It's not there to flaunt, flex its muscles like Israel is, which in the latter is the sign of defeat and of weakness. It is still operating on the defensive in the sense that there is a lot of priorities to basically keep the country stable with the midst of economic warfare against the world's hegemons, kind of working against it. So while the capability is there, Hezbollah knows that it has to basically play its cards right and not to really allow Israel to bait it into a war. As we see, like, Israel always wants to provoke, spread propaganda, accusing Hezbollah, also was mentioned in Sayyid Nasrallah's speech, of having either assassinated one of the U.S.'s propaganda assets, Luckman's team, or having stored weapons deposits in the port, which obviously we know is a complete lie. But basically, the propagation is to this sort of propaganda that Israel pushes and the U.S. and its agents in Lebanon like to parrot, aimed at essentially disarming Hezbollah, which is definitely also a sign that Israel knows that it can't compete or face off militarily. In the future, right now, I mean, we're seeing Israel going into further crushing defeat, further crumbling, even without any direct warfare. So I think that its attempts at psychological warfare are countered effectively already as it is. And so, I mean, we know that if in the effect that there's a disastrous war, it'll lose, and it looks like it's headed down that way either way.
Okay, I do have to ask your reaction, Leif Maruf. This is something that maybe is not highlighted as much, and is one of the things that Netanyahu said when that horrible explosion happened in Lebanon, in which hours before that explosion, the prime minister was at an Israeli military camp, and he issued a warning. It was an ominous warning. It said, quote, "We hit a cell, and now we hit the dispatchers. I suggest to all of them, including Hezbollah, to consider this." An official tour of a military facility in central Israel where Netanyahu said that. What do you think about that statement that Netanyahu made?
Well, you know, most probably apartheid Israel was somehow behind the explosion, but we don't have any of the investigations that have been announced, so I'm going to keep my sure position on this until we do. But yesterday, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in his speech referred to the fact that the multiple security apparatuses of Lebanon had conducted fully their investigations, that they have issued reports, and that they were handed over to the public prosecutor office, and that they need to be released because there are people still waiting to collect their money from the insurance companies that are refusing to pay, and so forth. And so, yes, we are living a multilateral war, and one thing that Sayyid Nasrallah referred to also in his speech yesterday was warning apartheid Israel that if they think they can conduct a few days of war and confrontation instead of a full-time war, full, full-scale war. They are not able to, and they have no power to decide that. That once the war starts, it's not going to be them ending it. And he reasserted the formula that if apartheid Israel decides to attack villages in Lebanon, that the response will be bombing colonies in apartheid Israel. That if they attack cities in Lebanon, the response will be attacking cities in apartheid Israel. So we, you know, yesterday in his speech, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah covered a lot of issues, and one of them is this warning to apartheid Israel not to play with fire.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much for that, activist and political analyst Laith Maruf, and thank you very much, journalist and political analyst Julia Qasem. Pleasure to have you both from Beirut. And that does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitale and the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Congress will move to establish an independent commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January, including facts relating to interference with the peaceful transfer of power. Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California announced on Monday, 15th of February. In a letter to her Democratic colleagues in the House, Nancy Pelosi also promised to move forward in coming weeks with emergency funding legislation for the safety of members and the security of the Capitol, after consulting with retired General Russell Honoré, whom she had asked to examine security on Capitol Hill. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Emily Cochran. The piece is titled, Pelosi Vows to Move Forward with Independent Inquiry into Capitol Riot. Stay with us for more of Emily Cochrane's article. The U.S. Congress will move to establish an independent commission to investigate the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January, including facts relating to the interference with the peaceful transfer of power, Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California announced on Monday, 15th of February. In a letter to her Democratic colleagues in the House, Nancy Pelosi also promised to move forward in coming weeks with emergency funding legislation for the safety of members and the security of the Capitol, after consulting with retired General Russell L. Honoré, whom she had asked to examine security on Capitol Hill. Security is the order of the day. The security of our country, the security of our Capitol, which is the temple of our democracy, and the security of our members, Nancy Pelosi wrote in the letter, adding that it was clear both from General Honoré's findings and from the impeachment trial that we must get to the truth of how this happened. Calls have grown for a bipartisan independent investigation into the law enforcement and administrative failures that led to the first breach of the Capitol complex in two centuries, particularly after the Senate acquitted former President Donald J. Trump in his impeachment trial on a charge of inciting the rioters. For some lawmakers, such a commission offers the last major opportunity to hold Donald Trump accountable for the Capitol riot. There's still more evidence that the American people need and deserve to hear, Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware, said over the weekend on ABC's This Week program, adding that the commission would make sure that we secure the Capitol going forward and that we lay bare the record of just how responsible Mr. Trump was for the attack. Establishing such a commission would most likely require legislation if it were modeled on the 9/11 Commission, which embarked on a 20-month investigation after President George W. Bush signed a law mandating the panel investigate what caused the September 11 attacks and how to prevent a similar attack in the future. The commission ultimately offered recommendations that led to the reshaping of congressional oversight and intelligence coordination. Nancy Pelosi said the panel would be assigned to investigate and report on the facts and causes relating to the Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, domestic terrorist attack upon the United States Capitol complex, as well as the interference with the peaceful transfer of power. A group of House Republicans wrote to Ms. Pelosi on Monday, 15th of February, complaining that she had tapped General Honoré without input from their party, and demanded that she answer questions about what she knew and what directions she gave ahead of the January 6 attack. Republicans have already objected to Nancy Pelosi's decision to install magnetometers outside the House chamber in response to concern about some lawmakers bringing firearms onto the chamber floor. It is easy to understand why we and our Senate counterparts remain skeptical that any of his final recommendations will be independent and without influence from you, wrote the Republicans, including Representative Rodney Davis of Illinois, the top Republican on the House Administration Committee, and Jim Jordan of Ohio, the top Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. Shaken by the siege and riot on Wednesday, 6th of January, which left many traumatized after hiding for their lives in their offices and in the House chamber, lawmakers have also asked to use campaign funds to pay for additional security in their districts. An emergency funding bill would be most likely help fund security for lawmakers in the districts, as well as at the Capitol, which remains surrounded by fencing and patrolled by National Guard troops.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.